This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. And I recycle. I have curbside service at my home, but I know I could be doing more to help out. And it turns out most of the state could be doing a lot more as well. Right now, though, we're going to focus on Indianapolis and why it lags behind a lot of other major cities. We're joined today by investigative reporter for the Indy Star, Sarah Bowman. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
You and your colleague, Emily Hopkins, who has also been on the show with us before recently, have done extensive reporting on what recycling looks like in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. You look at how our recycling stats stack up against other major cities. How did your team compare these cities? What data were you looking at?
Well, it was a lot of data that we actually went out and compiled and gathered ourselves. So we tried to find somewhere, you know, that had a database of recycling rates of cities across the U.S., and we really couldn't. We couldn't find one. So we decided, let's do it ourselves. And so it was a lot of calling around to – we decided to look at the top 50 largest cities, metropolitan areas in the country. And so it was a lot of calling around to those cities, working with them to – gather those recycling rates, and recycling rate meaning the amount of material that is kept from going to a landfill or an incinerator, kind of whatever their trash disposal method is. And we really did have to work with cities because kind of different municipalities calculate or gather that information in a different way. And so calling them, it was looking at different city reports and things that they had on websites in terms of, you know, numbers they had put out there, those sorts of things. And we just kind of created that database ourselves.
How did we do?
Not very well.
First of all, that sounds like a ton of work to call all of these. Were you looking at similar sized cities? Or
we just looked at the top 50 largest cities in the country. And so Indianapolis is about 14th, 15th largest metropolitan area in the country. And of the top 20, we have the worst recycling rate. So we are the largest municipality, city, metropolitan area in the country without a universal curbside recycling program for every resident.
Yeah, and your reporting, you talk about people who came to Indy from other cities and they realize the lack of the robust recycling program here. Can you talk about their reactions?
Yeah. So, I mean, one person I spoke to in particular, he'd come from Seattle, which has a really robust recycling program. It has an incredibly high participation rate of residents in the city, and they recycle more than 60%. Their recycling rate is more than 60%, so a lot. So, I mean, he describes recycling there as a way of life, I mean, almost a hobby. And he said when he came here to Indianapolis, he described recycling almost as a foreign language, you know, that so few people really knew about it or knew what was going on. And obviously it just there weren't many options kind of within the city to recycle.
I've sort of had the same reaction when I go elsewhere. You know, I went to Washington, D.C. in June, and I went to a place that had, I think, 7 bins in their kitchen area. You know, there's one for compost, one for this kind of plastic, one for this kind of, you know, waste. I guess the next natural question as to why we don't have a robust curbside recycling program is why? Why is it that we don't have bins available to every household?
Yeah, well, my question to you is, how much time do you have? there's quite a history there, and that goes back decades. I mean, more than 40 years was what we found once we really, because we asked that question ourselves. Okay, why is Indianapolis where it is? You know, why do we have such a poor recycling rate and program? And so we just kind of kept going back, and it started back in the 70s, really, when a lot of cities across the country, not just Indianapolis, were running out of landfill space. And so the city here created a task force to try and figure out what do we do? You know, what do we do because we're running out of space? And so that started, I think, in 1975. And it wasn't for another about 6 years that task force actually came to a conclusion. And that was to pursue an incinerator to burn our trash. And it wasn't for another about 4 years after that, 1985, I think, that we actually landed on a contract to do that. And then it was another 3 years after that that the incinerator burned its first, you know, load of trash. And so when you think about that, that's what, 12, 13 years? I'm doing math here. But, you know, that's a long time from when we first set out on this goal till we landed on an option. And at the time we were opening our incinerator, a lot of cities across the country were abandoning that option. They were, you know, abandoning those plans that they'd had or closing facilities that they already had open and pursuing recycling or other solid waste options. And that's just one aspect of it.
So the incinerator needs the city. The city needs the incinerator. Can you talk about what the city provided for the incinerator and vice versa?
Yeah. So when the city landed on the incinerator and started moving forward with that, there was obviously an investment that was made there that was to be paid back by the company, which was then Ogden Martin Systems, I believe. And so, you know, the city really needed them to succeed because they were, you know, paying this back. And so there were various things that were set up both in the contract and there was a city ordinance that was passed, for example, that haulers couldn't take their trash anywhere else if they operated within city limits. And that was later struck down because it was deemed unconstitutional for going against interstate trade. But then also within the contract, there was incentives to send as much trash to the incinerator as possible, both because the city got steam energy out of the incinerator. It was kind of billed as a form of recycling because you'd burn trash and get this steam energy that the city used to heat and cool its downtown buildings. But when you think about it, it's not really trash. Those materials are only being reused one time, whereas if they're recycled, obviously they can be reused multiple times. But so there was a way that it worked where the more the city sent to the incinerator, the less they got a break on their energy costs of the steam energy from that. So if they sent less, they paid more. There also was a contract or a clause in the contract that the city had to send a certain tonnage or a certain amount of recyclables to the incinerator. And if they did not stay above that threshold, they would pay a penalty. So there really were some things in place that kind of disincentivized creating a recycling program, or at least it certainly incentivized trying to send as much material to the incinerator as possible.
This is dizzying.
Yes.
Meanwhile, in the 90s, the state legislature introduced big changes to how waste was managed throughout the entire state, the rest of Indiana. What changes were made?
So the state passed a law that basically created a new way of managing our solid waste called solid waste management districts. And this was essentially meant to take management of this out of the political sphere. And it kind of created a separate independent body within counties to manage how waste was collected, set up recycling programs, and determine the rates that were needed. And that's kind of a key part of it to provide these services. But they exempted Marion County and only Marion County from this law.
Why?
Because honestly, a large part of it was because we had just gotten this incinerator up and running off the ground. And so, you know, it was kind of, we have this system in place. And so Marion County was exempted from creating its own solid waste management district. But that basically meant that solid management of solid waste was kept within city and within city government. And, you know, some sources that I spoke to have said that essentially it politicized management of solid waste.
A theme in your reporting is a lack of political will to implement a comprehensive recycling program. So what was the root of that hesitation?
Yeah, well, and that's kind of where the rates part comes in. And that was a big part of this lack of political will. And you can see it in multiple kind of points throughout this, you know, one of which is that this clause that you need to send a certain amount to the incinerator or pay a penalty, that was maintained and renewed in the contract over and over. And so that kind of can, despite various mayors and administrations saying, you know, we're going to do what we can to expand recycling, that stayed in there. And also, it really was just this mayors would say they want to expand recycling, but in most cases, that, you know, might take raising some rates or some taxes or whatever, you know, fee structure they might use. But that might make things a tiny bit more expensive. And, you know, there was a real lack of political will in terms of, you know, an administration or a mayor wanting to be remembered as the one that, you know, raised rates to accomplish something.
Well, and in fact, the solid waste fee hasn't risen in over 30 years. How is that possible?
Yeah, well, exactly. It wasn't just raising rates for recycling. I mean, it affects just the trash pickup as well. And that fee just no one really wanted to raise that. And so it stayed the same for like you said, 30 years. And that fee does not cover the cost of trash pickup in Indianapolis. And so already we're at a shortfall there that is having to be made up, drawing from a fund that the city has for such a thing. But that fund is being drawn down, and the city projects it could be depleted in a few years. So the city really does also feel the need to figure out a new structure and way of managing its solid waste.
In 2014, the city was offered significant resources to get a recycling program going. What was this offer?
So there are quite a few groups, both across the country and internationally, that are really focused on trying to bring recycling about, seeing the importance of it. And one of those groups is called the Closed Loop Fund, and they receive a lot of their funding from big companies like Pepsi and Johnson & Johnson, different companies. And so that group, the Closed Loop Fund, in 2014 offered Indianapolis financial support to help get a universal program off the ground interest-free. And they didn't. There wasn't a specific money amount tied to it, but a lot of the other cities who have received this kind of support from them have received anywhere between $3 and $7 million. So, I mean, not a small chunk of change. And that offer was kind of just left on the table here in Indy because it was happening at a time that then Mayor Ballard was kind of the city was working to establish another deal with Covanta to try and create their form of a universal recycling program, which would have essentially just had everything still go in one bin at the end of your driveway, you know, recycling garbage all in one bin, and then machines at the facility would have separated it there. But a lot of folks have said that wasn't going to work.
I want to know more, but we've run out of time. Read the article. Sarah Bowman, investigative reporter at the Indy Star, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we'll be talking about goals that Indianapolis has to improve its recycling efforts and what lessons can be learned from other Indiana cities. How do we implement a comprehensive recycling program? What role does education play in a successful initiative? I'm Matt Pelsa. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to the topic of recycling, I want to tell you about yesterday's show on AI and big data. Groundbreaking big tech industries that are changing the world as we know it. Lilly Endowment issued grant money to IU and Purdue to look into the ethics of big tech. We talked to the faculty members from both universities who are heading up those initiatives, and the discussion was fascinating. You can find a podcast of yesterday's show and all of our episodes wherever you get podcasts. Today we're talking about recycling in Indiana. What kind of recycling program does your city have? Are you happy with the options available to you? As always, we'd love your questions and comments on the topic. You can get them to us and we'll try to get them in front of our live panel. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Speaking of that live panel, we're joined now by Katie Robinson, Director of Indianapolis's Office of Sustainability. Hi, Katie.
Hello.
And Allison Mitchell, Executive Director of the Indiana Recycling Coalition. Welcome, Allison.
Hi.
And Jessica Davis, Director of IUPUI's Office of Sustainability. Thanks, Jessica.
Hello, absolutely.
Katie, we learned in the last segment that Indianapolis is the largest city in the country without universal curbside recycling. What are the city's goals around a comprehensive recycling program?
So under Thrive Indianapolis, which was the city's first ever Sustainability Resilience Action Plan, which was adopted earlier this year by the city, we have laid out the goal to have a universal curbside recycling program in place by 2025.
And that there's a fee that Indianapolis residents pay for annual waste removal that hasn't increased in decades. $32, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. And that falls far short of the actual cost of the service, as we heard in the last segment. How will we fund a curbside recycling program?
So we are very much, as Sarah pointed out, we're also sitting back and analyzing other cities and how they're paying for recycling and solid waste in general, so that we know what it's going to cost to implement a program by 2025. So we're looking at a number of variables to make sure that when we do pull that trigger, it's the best possible recycling program for Indianapolis. It doesn't, as Allison will often say, it doesn't just get us to 1995. We actually try to get to 2025. With an innovative program.
2025. Mm-hmm. Now, I have curbside recycling at my house, but I pay a little extra to have it. Mm-hmm. I don't mind doing it, but do you find it's a challenge to get people to get on board with that?
Roughly about 10% of our households in Marion County do subscribe to the service offered through Republic. We also have a number of residents that take advantage of the drop-off locations. There are about 24 drop-off locations throughout Marion County. We need people to be thoughtful about the type of material that they're placing into those drop-off locations. But otherwise, we do see good participation. We need to see better participation, though.
Jessica, right now Indianapolis residents have to pay a subscription fee to recycle, like I said, but you've talked about creative pricing incentives being a way to sustain recycling initiatives. Can you talk about what that means?
Absolutely. So when you look across the landscape of cities across the country, kind of as Katie mentioned, the city looking at other cities, some of the best incentives is what's called a pay-as-you-throw model, which means the more trash you throw away, the bigger your trash bill is. And then the cost of that increased trash container then on paper subsidizes the cost of recycling or compost. Recycling and compost aren't free, right? Nothing is free. There's always going to be a cost to haul that away, but you can inflate or make it to where it incentivizes people to do the right thing.
So when you say trash, you mean like garbage, non-recyclable
stuff? Yes, non-recyclable, non-compostable trash.
Allison, the Indiana Recycling Coalition operates statewide. Where do we see towns and cities doing a good job with recycling programs?
There are a lot of cities and towns in Indiana that are doing a great job. I like to cite Bloomington, Fort Wayne, even some Indianapolis suburbs are doing a great job with participation rates for their recycling programs.
And what do you think is different there? Like, is it local initiatives? Is it just a better attitude?
So in all of those communities that I just mentioned, they have a solid waste management district at the local level, that quasi-governmental entity that is charged with creating a solid waste plan for the county and also providing education. So that's a big part of it. But also a lot of those municipalities, they think about solid waste holistically. So it's not just garbage and recycling as an afterthought, but they provide both services to their residents, and that's what they pay when they pay their solid waste user fee. It's both to manage their trash and their recyclables.
Part of the bump in recycling rates across Indiana came from the creation of solid waste management districts in the 90s, and these groups serve as independent experts in developing recycling programs and setting the appropriate rates. If that strategy worked for other cities, could it work here?
Absolutely, and we think that's part of the solution in Indianapolis is, as Sarah mentioned, Indianapolis was exempted from that requirement. They were not prohibited from creating one. We've just never taken the opportunity to do that. So we think that's an entity that should be in place in Marion County for all the multiple functions that it provides. And again, it would help depoliticize solid waste management in the county.
And so, when I look at the timeline, that it seems like that happened so long ago, but so that really is rippling into now, and sort of the stats that she shared with us in the last segment as to why we're not doing so great.
Exactly.
Compared to other cities.
And a big part of what the solid waste management districts do is provide education to their residents about how to manage their solid waste. And that goes beyond trash and recycling. It talks about household hazardous waste, yard waste, all of the things that you need to get rid of as a resident. They have programs in place, and they have people that go and talk to the schools and provide that kind of on-the-ground education that's really It seems small in increment, but the totality of that is more than the sum.
Katie, does your office hear from the public on this issue? What kind of feedback or requests do you receive around recycling?
I mean, it's every day. We hear from people. They're excited. They're enthusiastic. They obviously want recycling a lot faster than 2025. We all took a step back and realized that it's probably going to take for us to design a system that works today. With all of the material that people are consuming, we need to take the time necessary to evaluate the most appropriate program for Indianapolis. But yes, I would say the public is incredibly excited, and they expect a world-class program in Indianapolis.
Allison?
So what Katie mentions is the frustration about why is it going to take until 2025? We get that frustration a lot, too. And we explain that we are having to undo this legacy problem that's been created over the last 30 years and the lack of education. We can't flip a switch on this. We could set bins at the bottom of everyone's driveway tomorrow. The logistics of that are challenging in their own, but that's not what's going to take us so long. What's going to take us so long is restructuring the contracts for the haulers in a way that provides proper incentives, making sure education comes first, because if people don't know what to put in which bin, they're going to the success of the program is going to be stifled. So the turning that tide, that cultural tide around education is going to take quite a while. And we've got to build the political will to invest in those ways.
And further emphasis on why 2025, right? Like this is it's a bit of ways. But every single contract related to how we move waste in the county is up for renewal in 2025. It gives us an opportunity to really, again, holistically evaluate the system and make sure we're putting in the best possible system in its place.
Ben from Twitter says, do your guests envision single stream recycling or having homeowners separate the recycling themselves? For what it's worth, I'd prefer the latter, he says. We'd go from one of the largest cities without universal recycling to one of the most efficient recycling cities. Your thoughts?
That's a really great question. And that's really a big topic of discussion amongst the whole industry in the whole country right now because of the China ban situation that's caused this whole industry to sort of hit the reset button. There are challenges in both methods. There's contamination challenges in the single stream for obvious reasons. You put all those things together in a bin together. They don't always play well together in one bin. But on the other end of doing dual stream, the system for pickup and the delivery method has really been optimized for single stream at this point. It's more efficient, and worker safety is protected when you have the automatic arms with the one bin, as opposed to workers, picking up those bins and dumping them by hand. So there's challenges in both directions, and I think that's exactly what we're talking about when we say it's going to take some time to really design the world-class system that Indianapolis deserves.
Jessica.
In speaking on behalf of a campus of 40,000, switching infrastructure from single-stream recycling to multi-stream recycling not only would take a huge infrastructure investment on our part, but also retraining our entire campus population, the extra labor, the extra material. I can imagine having, depending on how much you want to split your stream apart, 4, 5, 6 dumpsters behind every building for every material type. So you're dealing with a lot of infrastructure to accommodate these multiple waste streams.
Jessica, I'm going to stay with you. We're really talking about changing behavior here. What are the keys to helping people make daily habitual changes like recycling?
Yeah. So funny enough, I also teach at IEPUI a sustainability course, and we spend 2 days talking about how do you get people to change their behavior to be more sustainable. And almost all the literature indicates that education alone is never enough. So other things that we look at, number one being convenience. It doesn't matter. You can educate people to death, but if it's harder to do something or not as easy as to do something else, they're not going to do it anyway. Another big piece of that is incentive. And incentive means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. Sometimes the incentive is time. Sometimes it's money, right? Talking about that pay-as-you-throw model, you can use the carrot or the stick that way. But also a big one is actually social norming. So social norming is this idea that when I go down to my curb on my pickup day is Wednesday. On Wednesday, and I look at the curb, how many recycle bins do I see on my street, and do I see my neighbors participating in it? And that gets to that culture piece. So having a universal curbside program definitely puts us in the right direction of culture, but we also have to be sensitive to convenience and incentive too.
Can you walk us through a beginner's 101? You're also a teacher, a 101 guide to recycling. Where can someone who wants to recycle start?
Absolutely. So under the current model, go to the Office of Sustainability's website for the City of Indianapolis, also Indiana Recycling Coalition, heck, even our website. We all have resources about what goes in what bin. One thing that we try to preach on campus is to recycle right. So Allison talked about contamination and single stream recycling. So wish cycling, that man, I wish this wrapper was recyclable, so I'm just going to put it in there and hope that I'm right.
Ah.
That is often not the case. You are actually wrong. So we try to encourage recycling right. And when recycling is done right, that is what leads us to all the sustainability benefits, right? The social benefits, the economic, the environmental. Also, we want to make sure from an infrastructure standpoint, at least on campus, and it seems to be here in the Midwest, that blue is the color that indicates recycling. Does the bin itself act as an educational product? So do you have decals on the bin telling you what can go where? There have even been studies done looking at what kind of signage, right? What kind of images do you use? Do you use the clip art version? Do you use an actual photo? Do you use words with it, words alone? And the best combination seems to be actual photos of the item paired with language underneath it. And we also want to be sensitive about that language and that we want it to be positive, telling them what we want them to do, less so than telling them what we don't want them to do.
So wish recycling, this is a new term, and dirty recycling is sort of a new term that we've kind of uncovered, new to us anyway. Is that kind of wish recycling leads to dirty recycling?
Yes.
Is that how I'm understanding
it? Yes.
What do we do with greasy pizza boxes?
Oh, boy. It depends.
It depends.
We just talked about this out in the hallway. So pizza boxes, great cardboard material.
Sure.
Hopefully you have eaten the pizza out of it and there aren't any pieces left or crumbs or the little stand, table that you used for your Barbie when you were a kid. Hopefully that has been gotten rid of. If there's a little bit of grease, a little bit of cheese in that box, it's okay to be recycled. If it's like soaking in grease, you're probably going to want to put it into the trash can.
And maybe reconsider where you get your pizza.
Yeah.
Can you explain what e-waste is and how it should be disposed?
E-waste is electronic waste. So here in Indiana, we have to recycle our electronic waste. So that typically means you're going to send it to a tax drop or at least in Indianapolis, a place like Recycle Force. Or if you're at IEPUI, it'll go to our surplus property on campus where it'll be processed appropriately. Also, usually across the city, there are public recycling events. I think there's one coming up at the Indy Zoo here soon where you're able to take those electronics and have them disposed of properly.
What could you say to people who they look at all of this and it's just not the way they're used to living and they're discouraged and overwhelmed? What can you say to someone who's feeling that way?
I think the why recycling is seen as kind of the gateway drug to sustainability is because it is tangible. And usually the simplest way that I can address that is I'll ask my students, for one day, I want you to save all your waste and carry it with you. And if people would just think about that just for one day, what if we all had to store our own waste in our backyards?
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that long ago that we had to.
Exactly. Our behavior would change very quickly. So thinking about your impact as far as something that is visible and tangible will help you begin to go down that path of considering responsible alternatives.
From a perspective of sustainability, recycling is important, but it's not the only way to reduce waste. Allison, you say that there's intention behind the order reduce, reuse, recycle. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so that saying was created many years ago, and the effect, the impact that you can have as an individual is in that order. Reduce your waste. Don't create waste. That's the most sustainable thing to do. Reuse. That's a material, but you're using it multiple times. So it's got a longer lifespan. And recycle is third on that list because in a lot of cases, recycling is actually downcycling. It doesn't go on in perpetuity forever. It will get a couple of second and third lives, but eventually the material will degrade and it will end up in a landfill. So that's why recycling is the third on the list. And we do try to stress reduce and reuse our top priorities.
So it's a hierarchy. Reduce
yes.
the amount of trash you put out, reuse what you can, recycle what you can't.
Exactly.
Jessica, what are some other ways that people can be sustainable outside of just recycling? You talked about being the gateway drug.
One thing we talk about on campus is the culture of waste. And as Allison mentioned, reduction first. There are very simple changes that we can all make in our life to reduce the amount of waste that we generate. So I know plastic straws have gotten the spotlight here recently.
Sure.
So avoiding a straw if you don't need it, carrying a reusable one. But also, I think the biggest way we can have impact is how we spend our money. So every day, every time we spend a dollar, we tell a company with 100% of the value of this dollar, I support everything that you do. Be sensitive about how you spend that money. Spend it on products that you know you can reuse, or if you can't, you know the packaging is at least recyclable and won't go to trash.
Hmm. Katie, I'm going to end with you. We only have a little bit of time left. If someone wants to subscribe to the existing recycling services in Indy, how do they do it?
They can start by contacting the Mayor's Action Center, and they will provide information. By the way, that's 317-327-4MAC. And the Mayor's Action Center will provide information to connect residents to Republic services.
And our soda cans, our paper, our plastic containers, where do those currently end up when we recycle them?
They are ending up at the Republic MRF, which Allison helped me. The M is Material Recycle
Recovery Facility.
Sorry, it was always the M that gets me. But Allison has done a tremendous amount of work to with Republic and others to make sure that the material that is being recycled in Indianapolis is indeed being recycled. So no concern there.
Our thanks to Jessica Davis, Director of IUPUI's Office of Sustainability. Thanks for joining us, Jessica.
Mm-hmm.
That one always trips me up. And thank you to Katie Robinson, Director of Indianapolis's Office of Sustainability. Thanks, Katie.
Thank you.
Allison, we're going to hang on to you for the next segment, I think. And up next, we're talking about the economic opportunities that recycling offers Indiana. What potential for job creation exists? How can we strengthen a circular economy? Let us know if you have questions or comments for our live panel on Facebook or Twitter. Find us at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back now talking about the business of recycling. More than just a good deed, leaders across industries have recognized recycling as an economic opportunity on both the local and global scale. Joining us now is Alex Delnick, President and CEO of Verdeco Recycling, Inc. Alex, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Here's a big question out of the gate. Can you tell us what makes recycling good business?
I think that recycling should be a good business. And the reason why it should be a good business, it combines both sides of what we all as a society care about. It's economic considerations, number one. And second is our care for the environment and for clean air and clean water. We produce and use a tremendous amount of plastic. In this case, I'm talking about plastic that can be recycled. It's PET. It's number one plastic from which all the plastic bottles are made. And for the most part, we don't really use it effectively because it's a very good recycled material. So the business and recycling is good because it allows us to produce highly efficient packaging. And at the same time, post-consumer material can and should be used again and again, thus increasing efficiency of our packaging infrastructure.
So what are you doing with the PET?
We are doing what's called true bottle-to-bottle recycling. So PET enters the stream as resin, as a polymer from which bottles are produced. And it's so-called pellets or granules or PET resin. What Verdeco does, we produce this very material, PET, resin, granules, pellets, but we produce material that is 100% post-consumer content. So through a series of steps, we use 100% post-consumer feedstock, and we produce material that can go back into bottles over and over and over again. And if you go to supermarkets, if you go to Costco and you find bottles, and the label it says 50%, for example, post-consumer content, 50% are PET. Majority of that resin comes from the Verdeco plant.
And you're based in California, but a few years back, 2016, you opened a plant in Terre Haute. What attracted your company to Indiana?
Indiana is a great state to do business in, very, very business friendly, strategically located. If you look at the map, and I have a map in my office, Indiana is a great location, great people, great business environment, very friendly business environment. And we can deliver from that plant in Indiana, and we do deliver to pretty much all Midwestern states and as far south as Georgia and Texas. So it's a very good strategic location, good business environment. And of course, it's, you know, where our suppliers and customers are.
Do you think there are opportunities for the recycling business to grow in Indiana?
I think it's a great question. It's not a simple answer to the question. I think the strategic location and ability to deliver to customers from Indiana are tremendous. It's a great opportunity. However, Indiana state as a source of post-consumer feedstock may not necessarily be the best. The collection rates are still, you know, lower, much lower than it should be. And therefore, we cannot create truly a circular economy within Indiana or even within neighboring states because of the low collection rate in the state. So we need feedstock, and feedstock comes from post-consumer material. And if we want to create true recycling industry in Indiana, in addition to manufacturing facilities like Verdeco facility, we should have a robust collection system.
And you just returned from an international plastic trade show in Germany. What trends are happening around recycling globally, and how do initiatives within the U.S. compare to programs across the globe?
I think it's a great question. I did just come back from the CASE show, which is the largest plastic show in the world. It's held once every 3 years in Germany. And the trends are something that we've seen in the U.S., but on a much larger scale. Collection rates in Europe are much, much higher, and demand for post-consumer material in Europe is much higher than it is in the U.S., and it does help to create and to spur development of the industry. I think that the biggest difference that we see between Europe, which is, unfortunately, I have to admit that Europe is ahead of us, in terms of utilizing post-consumer materials and mandates to use recycled content in plastic packaging. But also, it's ahead of us in the collection of post-consumer PET. And one of the reasons is a strong regulatory mandate that exists in most of the countries in Western Europe and in Western Europe as a joint single economy. The trend that we see is more and more recycled material that goes back into productive use. Less and less materials go into landfills. Less and less post-consumer material is wasted or downcycled.
What do you think would make people in the U.S. be more likely to contribute to the collection rate?
I think the collection rate is something that we can improve rather fast. I think that whether we have a willingness to do that, it's a separate issue. It's not an easy thing to say if you really consider the recycling industry in totality. It's clear, there is nobody doubts that deposit systems that exist in 10 states in the United States, and Indiana is really close to one of them, Michigan, which has had deposit system for a while, and collection rate there are numbers and numbers of times more than it is in Indiana. I think the dream should be that plastic bottle, once manufactured, doesn't venture too far from the place it is manufactured. It's consumed in the area, it's recycled in the area, and it's used for production of new bottles very close where it was first manufactured. So I think that Indiana can be a great state. There are some facilities in Indiana that can take the bottles and produce very good quality feedstock, and Verdeco can convert it to a resin that can be used by multiple plants producing bottles in the state of Indiana. There are quite a few of them. So that, to me, is the easiest, the most straightforward step towards increasing collection rates and improving economics of recycling.
Alex Delnick, President and CEO of Verdeco Recycling, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And we're joined again by Allison Mitchell, the Executive Director of the Indiana Recycling Coalition. And we're pleased to welcome Stacy Boggs, the Midwest Region Sales Manager of Pratt Industries. Stacy, great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Allison, what do you make of Alex Delnick's comments about Indiana needing to have more available recyclable material for business around recycling to really thrive?
Yeah, I agree. And it's a common refrain that we hear as an organization. You know, we have a low collection rate and we need more feedstock. That's what a lot of manufacturers in the state say that use recycled content in their manufacturing processes.
Annabeth on Facebook says recycling may not be the answer any longer with China and other Asian countries refusing to accept American recyclables. Much of the material is ending up in landfills. It's time to talk about reducing our waste, especially single-use packaging and other items, as a top priority. Allison, what do you think of that?
She's absolutely right. But I will say something that gets lost in the, especially in national media when it comes to the China ban situation. Indiana is actually really well positioned to take the China ban situation and make it an economic opportunity. We have the manufacturing base here that wants those materials, as Alex just stated. We have the processors who take it from your curbside bin, turn it into a standardized material, the pellets that he spoke about, and then that becomes the end product for those manufacturers. We have the transportation logistics network of our Crossroads of America. We have ports. We have airports. We have all of those transportation networks that we need to move materials quickly and efficiently and affordably. And we also have champions that at the local level in the solid waste management districts that want to help their communities change those behavior and provide those feedstock to the manufacturers. So what's happening in other states where they were very reliant upon China to take the physical materials, that is not affecting Indiana in the same way. We never, as a landlocked state that didn't have ready access to those ports, those international ports, we did not send our materials to China. But what the impact that that has had on Indiana that no one is immune from is what it's done to the commodity values. So we do have that impact here. But we can take this situation where other states in the country are looking for new end markets because China is gone and will never return. And we can leverage the infrastructure that we have in place to be the new end market for a large portion of the country.
Stacy, you're a sales manager of Pratt Industries, which has a location in Valparaiso. Can you talk a little bit about what your company recycles?
Absolutely. So we are America's fifth largest corrugated packaging company and the world's largest privately held 100% recycled paper and packaging company. After saying all that, simply stated, we produce cardboard boxes. What makes us unique is that we make our roll stock out of 100% recycled fiber. So when you mentioned earlier that you take your recycling out to the curbside bin, we need that paper. So your magazines, your junk mail, your pizza boxes, clean-ish, if you will. We take all of those, and after they are processed, those come to our Valparaiso paper mill, and in a few short days, turn back into roll stock. We like to say that we harbin the urban forest as we use no virgin fiber and we destroy no trees to make our 100% recycled cardboard.
And I've heard that paper is one of the more valuable commodities in the recycling world. Why is that?
Mostly because of the reuse of that. So there's many different facets to plastic recycling. There's different types of paper recycling into what grade they go into. But almost every certain part of a fiber or box has a recycled content to it. We have 100% recycled content. It is much easier to get fiber from recycled fiber than going out and harvesting the trees, etc. So that's why it is valuable. And the comment mentioned earlier that you said that, you know, there is no more recycling because China has shut down their recycling capabilities. We need that paper in Indiana. You know, we chose Valparaiso, Indiana to put our box plant. We did that in 1999, and it is North America's largest producer of cardboard boxes. So when we put our fourth paper mill, decided where to put that, we put it in Valparaiso. So essentially, the paper comes in one end, we make the roll of paper, we conveyor it to the box plant, and then we produce the boxes. another fact is that those boxes go to Indiana companies. So we're shipping to Amazon, Delta Faucet, Lowe's, Cummins Engine. And when we deliver those boxes, in turn, they're putting their recyclable fiber on our trucks, and we are going straight back to the mill with those. So it really is close the loop and kind of circular economy that we're working with.
So you're collecting recyclable material from the clients that took the boxes in the first place. Where else are you getting plant material from?
Sure. So you mentioned Republic Services as well. So there are many haulers or waste companies that do process the paper for us. So they may sort it. There are different grades of paper. So you can have a very white stream of paper that is SOP, which is sorted office paper, that might go to make, you know, a clearer or a more white piece of paper. We take mixed paper and cardboard. We pulp that. Sometimes we will get, green strapping, we may get plastic in there. We pull that out in the pulping process, and then we dry those fibers and create the large rolls that we have. There's all different types. We make cardboard boxes, but there are many other types of paper. So if you see a cereal box or a soda carton, if you look at those fibers, those are all recycled as well. So we really need those. I don't want to go to other states to get the fiber that I need here in Indiana. I want to keep the fiber here. So I encourage the residents, make sure that you are doing your curbside recycling. If you can't afford that, as mentioned earlier, feel free to go to the city website and see where you can drop off that. You know, when I walk my dog in the city and I see people put their cardboard boxes into the trash stream, it hurts, because we really need that here, and that's what's going to help our economy. We employ 600 green-collared workers, as we call them, in the state of Indiana. And it's because of our recycling MRFs. We own our own logistics team. We have 150 trucks daily that go out and deliver that fiber. So paper is strong, and the economy for paper is strong in Indiana. And I just encourage everybody to make sure that they are really recycling those commodities.
Allison, let's talk about jobs. What kinds of job creation opportunities does the recycling industry offer? Other than what she just mentioned.
Right. It's really interesting. There's a statistic that we did in our 2013 job study. One ton of material sent to a landfill will create roughly one job. One ton of material that is recycled will create 10 times, so 10 jobs. And that is most people don't really think about what happens after the bin, after they put the, you know, materials on the curb. But when you send your materials, your trash to the landfill, it's a one-way ticket, right? There's a truck driver. Maybe there's somebody at the plant where they're either incinerating or at the landfill. When you put your recyclables in, that starts a process that touches many people and employs many people, from the sorting of the materials at the materials recovery facility, which happens here locally, to the processing to get it into that standardized material like the bale of paper or the pellet of plastic, and then into the manufacturing stream. And every time it moves from one location to another, that's another truck driver that's employed. So there's just the 10x effect for recyclables is really interesting, and it's really undervalued, I think, in the state of Indiana.
Got about a minute left. Allison, can you talk about what it means to strengthen a circular economy when we talk about recycling? I like that term.
Yeah, so a circular economy is basically closing the loop on a material. As Stacey mentioned, paper and cardboard, that loop is closed in the state of Indiana. We can actually close the loop on all the materials in the state of Indiana because of the manufacturers and the processors that we have here. It's really just meant to say those materials are utilized. Molecules are kept in motion rather than disposed of. So that's what that means.
And who are the stakeholders then involved in making that closed loop possible with other materials?
It's really everybody. Obviously, the recycling industry is a big part of that, but it's also the transportation and logistics folks. It's the product manufacturers and the designers. Designers have a big role to play, also underutilized.
Do we see any independent actors or businesses taking it upon themselves to act sustainably rather than waiting for government incentives?
Absolutely. There's a lot of cases of that where there's businesses that have gone to zero waste, where they are tired of paying escalating fees to dispose of their waste, and they're trying to find creative ways to either minimize that waste, reuse materials, or recycle it to divert it from landfill. So that's a whole other radio show.
We'll plan on it. Allison Mitchell, the executive director of the Indiana Recycling Coalition, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Stacey Boggs, Midwest Region Sales Manager of Pratt Industries. Stacey, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show's engineered by Adam Gross. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it wherever you get podcasts. Join us tomorrow for spooky stories of Indiana ghost lore as we creep up on Halloween. Feel free to share your stories on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.